A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah.
This is Elena Turdi from Dresden, Germany, and you're listening to a gem among podcasts, the Tennis Podcast.
So thank you very much, Eleanor. What an absolutely lovely intro to the show, Catherine, and fitting that it is for a show in which you are interviewing somebody who is as wonderful as Esther Vergeer, as everybody's going to get to hear. But Eleanor has really got the right idea, I think, for the intros.
Yes, I'm always fabulously impressed by people who can use colloquialisms in their non-native language. So to call us a gem of a podcast in what is at least Eleanor's second language, I find very impressive and heartwarming.
Indeed. And Matt, hello. How are you?
Hello. Fine, thank you. I think Eleanor started the intros arm race that developed last year. She did one for us last year as well and jazzed it up and ever since has sort of set the bar. So thank you, Eleanor.
How wonderful. Oh, well, if you didn't know, the reason Eleanor got to introduce our show is because she helped to fund the Tennis Podcast in 2021. She was part of our crowdfunding effort at the end of last year. We'll be doing the same thing again at the end of this year. And if you want to introduce a show, you'll be able to then. So something a bit different for today's Tennis Podcast. We have an interview for you with Esther Vergeer, who is pretty much the most successful tennis player that has ever lived. And we are going to tell her story in her own words. Catherine got to speak to her a couple of months ago, and it's a wonderful interview. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it enormously. Just to give you a little bit of background about Esther, as I said, I mean, Matt's going to give you some of the statistics about her wheelchair tennis career. But to let you understand a little bit more about her background, she was born in the Netherlands in July 1981. She began having health problems, dizziness, and unconsciousness at the age of six, and suffered strokes, which it turned out were caused by abnormalities in her spine. She required a 9-hour surgery, which saved her life, but it left her paralyzed from the waist down. Looking back on that period in her life, she said in an interview with Laureus in 2012, that you have this image of how everything will be, and then all of a sudden everything changed. You have to relearn everything. That was the hardest part. I couldn't get dressed the normal way I was used to. I couldn't play soccer the way I was used to. I couldn't go out for sleepovers with friends the way I used to. But I think because of sport, I relearned very quickly and realized what I could and what I couldn't do. And she went on to learn how to play wheelchair volleyball, basketball, and then tennis. And in tennis, Matt, is where things really came to fruition and she started to become a serious athlete. I mean, when you look at some of her achievements, before we actually hear from her in her own words about her own journey, the actual achievements are mind-boggling on any level that I've ever heard about. And I think, they're unparalleled in the sport.
Yeah, I don't really know where to start with this list of achievements, to be honest. It's one of the most spectacular careers in tennis, as you've said, spanning from the late 90s until her retirement in 2013. And full disclosure here, there is actually quite a lot of inconsistency in the reporting over how many Grand Slam titles she won in her career. There's consensus that she won 21 Grand Slam singles titles, all the events she entered, and she still holds the record for the most Grand Slam wheelchair women's singles titles. Worth noting that Wimbledon only introduced wheelchair singles after Vergeer had retired. But then the number of Grand Slam doubles titles that she won, in some places I've seen it reported as 27, which would bring her Grand Slam total up to 48. But I actually think she won 23 Grand Slam doubles titles, because the ITF reported last year that Shingo Kunieda at the US Open won his 45th Grand Slam wheelchair title overall, which was overtaking Vergeer's record at the time of 44. So 44 Grand Slam titles in total across singles and doubles. What we know for sure is that she holds the record for the most tour-level wheelchair singles titles with 169, and in doubles with 136. She spent more than 650 weeks as the world number one. She won 8 Paralympic medals, including 7 golds, 4 straight singles golds, 3 doubles golds, and doubles silver. She won 14 consecutive year-end championships from 1998 until 2011. And between August 2004 and October 2006, she won 250 consecutive sets, with only one of them going to a tiebreak. But I think the record she's most known for is the streak, her winning streak of 470 matches, only bettered by one professional athlete in all of sport, a Pakistani squash player, who won 555 consecutive matches.
That was Jahangir Khan, wasn't it?
Jahangir Khan, exactly. And that streak forms a large part of the interview that Catherine did with Esther Vergeer, and there's absolutely fascinating insight.
Because I'm obsessed with it.
It is one of those things, though, isn't it, Catherine? I mean, you know, we're going to hear about the detail from Esther herself, but we were obsessed with it. I remember at the time, thinking back to when I was covering the sport, you just got to the end of a tournament and Esther Vergeer had won it. That's just the way it was. So that encapsulated my entire career, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it made me fall down a bit of a Jahangir Khan rabbit hole, actually, because I was so mesmerised by just the concept and the psychology. Well, you hear in the interview, but the psychology of being invincible for that longer period of time. Yeah, just to experience something that so few people on the planet have ever experienced. You know, not even Roger Federer or Serena Williams or Novak Djokovic have experienced, not even Rafael Nadal on clay has experienced that level of invincibility. I don't know if I should have asked her whether she ever got to meet Jahangir Khan. Wish I could go back and ask her.
He's a name from my childhood, because I remember him clocking up that record as well when I was young. But let's hear from Esther Vergeer herself, shall we? Catherine spoke to her in January, and she's had a really difficult year. Everybody has, but Esther more than most. And Catherine started by asking how she is.
I'm doing well. Of course, I was diagnosed with breast cancer in the beginning of 2020, and so the year for me started, well, a little bit, scary, because I didn't know what the end was going to be or how the treatment was going to be. But to be honest, I had a really good treatment and everything went well. And in August, I was done with all the treatment and I was, well, healthy again. So that's what they said. And I feel healthy. I feel very fit at the moment. So I started, and maybe that was just because of I was diagnosed with cancer. I realized that in some cases, you just have to stop and have and take the time for yourself to take a rest or to start to do some daily exercises again. Because when I retired as a wheelchair tennis player, I didn't have that structure of playing sports, of being active anymore. And sometimes you just forget to eat healthy and to play sports. So that's what I put back in my daily routine. And I have to say that I feel maybe fitter than I did before. So I'm doing well.
Gosh, I'm so pleased to hear that. That's fantastic news. What's it like as a professional athlete to get a diagnosis like that? Does it knock you for six? Does the fact of being a professional athlete, do you think that makes it more difficult to deal with?
Well, the difficult thing was that is something. It's like a message. It's a thing. It's a fact where you have no influence on. So everything that needs to be done to get it fixed or to become healthy again is out of control, and you have just no clue what it's going to be like. And that was the hard part for me, that you have, I mean, it's a treatment that the doctors give you and hopefully will fight the cancer and make you better, but you just don't know. And I guess that was the most difficult part for me. But on the other hand, I think, being an athlete, or the fact that I was an athlete, helped me also to put myself in a strict regime of putting priorities first. The doctor gave me a strict schedule, and I just had to do that with the treatments and with the period of rest and taking care of yourself. And I think I know how to do that. And I think that is one of the things that that helped me, taking this disease step by step. And I guess that as an athlete, you know how to do that as well. You have like an end goal, and you have steps in between that you have to take, and results that you want to reach. And then step by step, you just do your trainings and do your treatments. And in my case, that helped. Yeah.
I was reading some quotes of some of your peers and competitors and doubles partners, things that they've said about you over the course of your career. And I was reading Sharon Wolverine said, said your mental strength was what completely set you apart from everybody else in the sport. She said about you, she has the remarkable calmness and mental focus that puts her at a different level than the rest of us. And I imagine that's been something that is been a tremendous asset to you throughout the last year. Has that always been the case for you? Is it something that comes naturally, that mental strength?
I don't know if it's naturally, but I know that I put a lot of effort in it. So I did a lot of training, mental coach and sports psychologist trainings in the beginning of my career, because I knew that that would or could be one of the assets that would help me in my tennis career. And I know, or I was convinced, that the combination of your brain and your physical abilities, that is connected with each other. So if I would have, the most control of my brain, I would have the most control of my physical body and my performance. And so I put a lot of effort in there and time in there to get it as well balanced or perfect as possible. I guess she has a point in where, if I look back on my career, there was not a lot of times that I was completely stressed out, or there was not a lot of times that I was worried or out of focus on my tennis matches. Of course, I was nervous, and of course, I was sometimes insecure about my performance, but I always kind of knew how to get myself back on track. I have to agree that in this last year, and it comes to breast cancer, but also the COVID-19 situation with, being chef de mission, and helped me. I mean, the mental strength and to see priorities and to see where you have influence on or where not, or how to calm yourself or how to calm others, was something that I could still use in this last year as a, on personal level, but also on professional level.
The decision to employ a sports psychologist in your career, did you make that very early? Did you always have a sports psychologist working with you?
I guess when I made the decision, and it feels like I always say that it is a decision, but when you're at the point that I was in this pinpoint in my career. I just won the US Open in 98, And in 2000, there was the first Paralympics, and I made this decision to really wanting to go for, attending the Paralympic Games in Sydney. I also decide to, contact a sports psychologist to help me. And so actually, from the beginning on, when I started to, put myself big goals on my tennis list, I also contacted this person, to help me, because I knew that, nutrition and like your mental abilities would help to perform better.
Are you surprised that more tennis pros don't employ a sports psychologist? We had Iga Świątek talking about it at the French Open, didn't she? She had a psychologist with her there, but that was quite a big story at the time because it was quite unusual, I think.
I don't know this particular case, but I am surprised, and not in tennis specifically, but in sports generally, that it's still, and I think it's more common in sports than it is in like the professional working world, so to speak. But I'm surprised that not everybody or every athlete or even teams don't always have this kind of person to help a team or an individual basically 24/7. And I didn't hire one for 24/7 a day, but I knew that this person, which you have to build a relationship with and you have to get to know, that it takes time for you to really see the effect, and it takes time to really see the influence that your brain have on your performance. I'm hoping, and I'm telling athletes now at the moment, younger athletes, to always take that aspect of sport into account when they start their professional sporting career, because it's so important, and it's maybe also not only during your sporting career, but also afterwards, or when you make the decision to end your professional sporting career or to step into the real or normal world, it will help you to become a stronger person in general, as a whole, I guess.
That's really interesting. I know you played national level basketball before becoming a tennis pro. What attracted you away from basketball and in the direction of tennis, away from a team sport and in the direction of the individual?
Yeah, and I guess that is the answer at the same time, because tennis is an individual sport, and you're not depending on a team, and you're not depending on the people that have a place in that team, where you don't get to pick the people. And I guess I really was triggered by the fact that you can plan your own route, and that you can pick your own people around you, and you can figure out your own way or your route that you want to take with your own standards and with your own level of professionalism. And I guess that was the trigger for me, besides that I loved the game, being responsible for my own performance and results, not depending on anybody else. And I guess that was, taking that responsibility was something that I was attracted to. Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you played wheelchair tennis?
I do remember in my rehabilitation center that I was introduced with tennis. And it's a complicated sport for wheelchair tennis players, because it's not only the racket that you have to control, it's also your chair and the pushing and then the technique of tennis, of course, and then a combination of all those things. So it was complicated, but the people that taught me, the people that I was introduced to who already played wheelchair tennis, they were nice. They were open. They were honest about, the possibilities in tennis. So that pulled me into the sport, I guess.
Do you remember a moment of thinking, this is what I want to do? this is what I want to make my career and my life.
Well, I guess back in the days, because we were talking about a long, long time ago, there was no talking about this is a professional opportunity. I wasn't even aware of Paralympic Games because at that time there was no Paralympic Games on television. I had no clue. I just had, you know, I became paralyzed and I had no clue about the disability world, so to speak. So it was just talking about fun and in which sport. I knew I wanted to play sports more often because that was something that I could put my energy in. That was something that I felt strong about because, you know, going back to school as a 8, 9, 10 year old, being confronted with your disability was quite heavy sometimes. And so sports gave me the opportunity to just be active and had fun. And so those were the main reasons why I just liked to play sports. Only later on, I was, you know, getting more informed about wheelchair tennis and the opportunities and the possibility of maybe, you know, become a Paralympic athlete and maybe join the Paralympics. So later on, I was triggered on becoming the best. And of course, people were telling me that. They were like, wow, Esther, you're such a young athlete and you have good hand-eye coordination. And what if you, you know, start to train with us in Amsterdam and not just with your local club? Maybe you can become better and maybe you can become a really good player. And, you know, giving or getting those compliments was something that wanted me to, to get the more out of myself. Yeah.
The Netherlands is one of the most successful nations in terms of para sports, disability sports. And there are sort of a few nations that do seem to kind of lead the way and have led the way for a long time. Why is that? What is the attitude and how has it sort of evolved over the years towards disability sport in the Netherlands?
I guess with all sports, and if we look at the Paralympic Games and we see ourselves as a small country with not a whole big team, but we always end like within that top 10 position of the medal ranking, I guess this is because we are organized very well. We're a small country, so we can train with each other. We can share knowledge with each other. We share experts with each other, and we are fully integrated. So our Paralympic athletes get the same opportunities and knowledge and experts as the Olympic athletes, the same financial support as the Olympic athletes. And I guess that makes the level of professionalism very high. And I guess that makes us good. And besides that, the Netherlands is a developed country if it comes to people with disabilities. So, and I guess there's always steps to take forward, and there's always steps to take or to go to a better place. But I guess we are in a position that we as people with disability are fully accepted in the society. So we get fair chances on education and playing sports, getting our equipment, wheelchairs, prosthetics, stuff like that. That's probably one of the reasons why we do so well.
Has that always been the case? Is it something you felt shift? Because thinking about the UK, in terms of perception, it felt like there was a huge shift after the Paralympic Games here in 2012, mm-hmm. in terms of perception of disability yeah. sport. What's that been like in the Netherlands over the years?
I'm waiting for that step to be made in the Netherlands, to be honest. I'm kind of jealous of the step that the UK made after the London Paralympics. And I think that the Netherlands is not at the same level, but I think in, I don't know, perception, like you said, or the mentality of the people or the expectations towards Paralympic athletes could take the next step. And I think that once we have or would have such a, you know, big event in the Netherlands, we could make that switch. And it's about, you know, the commercial opportunities for athletes or communication about wheelchair tennis or disability sports, but also communication about Paralympics. I think that could take a next step or should take a next step. And I'm waiting for that, or I'm working hard to break that barrier. And I'm not too sure what's needed for that, but I know that having such a big event like a Paralympics would help and has helped the UK. So yeah, we're somewhere in the same position, I guess. But like I said, with communication and commercial opportunities, I think the UK is a step ahead of us.
Just focusing on your career a little bit. I mean, it's difficult to know what to zero in on because just so many titles, so many highlights. Do you have achievements that you think about more than others or are most proud of, moments or titles?
Well, there's this moment that I always mention, and it's because it was such a it's the Paralympic final of Beijing 2008, and I was playing Corey Holman. She's also Dutch, and we had this a fight I don't know, for many years, but she had never won. She'd never beat me. And in that final, she was match point. She had match point on me. And so this situation was stressful and unknown to me. And of course, I told myself that I, you know, wanted to make or win this gold medal there. Didn't want to lose to Corey in the Paralympic Games. So that was very, I don't know, tight situation and stressful, not only to me, but also to Corey, of course, because now she was just one point away of beating me and beating me at the most important maybe moment in her career. And then eventually I could turn this match point around and turn the match towards a win for myself, winning this gold medal. So I guess, yeah, that moment is just standing out because it was such an important moment, because it was so stressful, and of course that it turned around in a positive way for me. That I will never forget that moment.
So that match was sort of right in the middle of your extraordinary 470 match winning streak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think kind of what came after it could have been different if that winning streak had been snapped at that moment?
Yeah, I guess it could. I think it could. Yeah. A lot of times I was thinking or told myself, what if I lose now and take that pressure off my shoulder? Would I perform different or would I feel different? Or and I get the answer could be yes, that I wouldn't feel as much pressure, and maybe I would have played more freely, or wouldn't worry so much about losing, because I had those moments that I was just more worried about losing than I was focusing on winning. And there were times that I didn't like that, and I didn't enjoy playing tennis anymore because of that, because it's not fun if you're just worried all the time. So yes, I think it would have been different. I don't know if the results would have been different. That I don't know, but maybe the feeling would have been different for me when playing. Yeah,
that's fascinating. I'm so fascinated by the winning streak, because I mean it's so rare. I think it's the second longest in all known sport.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah,
that
I think there's one squash player,
yes,
who has more winning streak.
It's,
yeah,
just extraordinary. So it's kind of something that not many people can understand or empathize with. Did it feel lonely at all being in that position?
No, lonely is the wrong word. Sometimes I've felt that people were more paying more attention to the streak than the actual win that I had on that moment. I don't know if that makes sense, but for me, the winning streak was not the goal that I had. So for me, it was, you know, tournament by tournament, or I was aiming for the Grand Slams or, you know, those Paralympic medals, what counted for me, and not the streak itself. And so when I retired on the 470th, people were asking me, oh, why don't you go for the 500 or for the 550? Or because they were like, well, that must be your aim, or that must. But I was not. That was not my main goal. So, yeah, I guess the streak is just something that came with my sporting career, but it's not a goal itself.
Do you remember when you first sort of started to be really aware of it? Maybe when you first started to be asked about it all the time, when it became a big feature of your career?
Yeah, I think, but I'm not too sure when that was, but I think it was around, or maybe at the time that I was at this 250 streak or something. I don't even know what year that was. but some countries or some journalists were more into it than others. And for example, in America, they're all about statistics and numbers. And so whenever I played in America, there were more talks about it than wherever in the world. So sometimes I was just not busy with it at all. And in some tournaments, I was confronted with it all the time.
Did you ever feel invincible?
No, never. No. No, because I was just... I realized that any moment, any time, there could be a moment that I would have a bad day, or somebody would have a really good day, or my preparation were not good enough, or the conditions were different than I expected. So at any time, something could happen. And I guess that was the time in 2003, I lost first round to Daniela De Toro in Australia. And I was so mad at myself that I just did not do the preparations well enough, that I was not prepared for the wind, not prepared for the temperature in Australia, not prepared. So I was just didn't do my preparations well. And that was for me a moment that I was so mad at myself that I made the decision not to be, you know, bad prepared at any time anymore. So I always had to be well prepared. And wow. That's when I started to win.
Was the streak a factor in your retirement decision? Were you wanting to retire with the streak preserved?
No, because otherwise I'd probably retired earlier or sooner, in an earlier year. A consideration that I wanted to end the career not losing. No, I knew that the risk of losing, of course, was there every single time, and would maybe become a bigger risk than at that moment, because I was becoming older and players were becoming better. But the main reason why I retired was that I just couldn't find the motivation anymore to be away from home so much, that I realized that at my 31st, I was needing to prepare for a social career, or, you know, a career after my tennis career, and that I could use my tennis or my status or my performance at that moment to maybe, you know, get work in sports, where I would love to work. And so all those things together, I guess, were the reasons why I retired in 2013.
Did it feel completely right? Was it one of those sort of, you know when the time is right? Or were there bits of you that wondered, oh, maybe I could play on, maybe I could extend the streak, maybe I could get to 500?
Yeah, it was. I wasn't sure about anything anymore, because I wasn't sure whether I wanted to continue, because I didn't have the motivation, but I also wasn't sure about what would come, or how the world after tennis would look like, or what I would do, or who I would be without a record. So everything was insecure or unsure. And for a couple of years, that was the feeling that I have. And I never regret the fact that I retired. I never regret the fact that I ended my career at the moment that I did. but I had a lot of questions, a lot of years, like who I was and what I wanted to do and am I good enough? And sometimes I was, you know, lonely in my bed, thinking about maybe, you know, making a comeback, because sometimes it's just very comfortable to go back to a world that you have so much confidence. Mm. And the lack of confidence I had in this other world or the normal world didn't feel nice, didn't feel nice. But like an official comeback I never made. It was just a thought that I had in the middle of the night. And then I woke up the next morning and I was like, nah, this is not, this wouldn't be right. I just had to put through this uncomfortable feeling and I just have to gain confidence with all the things that I'm going to do. And that just takes time. I spoke to other athletes that retired and they all have the same feeling. It's just a different world and you have to get used to it. And so it's not a crazy or it's not weird that you feel a little bit lost. You just have to give yourself the time to get used to it.
I read that during the final 10 years of your career, you won 95 matches without losing a game. Did you enjoy those kind of wins, that kind of dominance, or would you have preferred a narrow, competitive, hard-fought win?
I would have preferred a little bit more competition. Yeah, because that is what you want to have as an athlete. You want to compete, and you want to fight, and you want to play your best to show yourself that all the effort that you put in is worth it and that you need it to win that one match. So yeah, I would have preferred a little bit more competition. Yeah.
There was quite a lot of people, us in the media, during those years of your career that speculated about whether your dominance was bad for the game. Did that bother you?
No, it didn't bother me at all because I had those same questions. And how nice it would have been if there would be more competition. But then also the fact that it's not my fault. It's not something that I have influence on. So it didn't bother me because I completely understood why those questions were raised. Only I didn't have the answer. And above that all, it wasn't my fault. But I guess that's for Paralympic sports in general. I mean, there's just not as much Paralympic athletes or disabled athletes as there are able-bodied athletes. So it's a very logical result of how the world is. And that's just a fact that I think we have to learn to live with.
Learn to live with or learn to change?
Well, I guess we all, I would like to, that we work hard to get more people with disabilities into sport, because that would be good. And to make the competitions in all different sports as competitive, as professional as possible. Mm. And so we have to work hard for that. And we as athletes, we as organizations, we as International Paralympic Committee, we as able-bodied federations. So to develop disability sports as a whole.
And in terms of, you know, the levers that you pull, the mechanics of that, is the main thing funding? Is it as simple and as crude as funding, or is it something more social about attitudes to disability and disability sport?
As a reason for it to grow, you mean?
Yeah.
It's definitely not only funding. No, it's also the attitude, like I said, the integration within able-bodied sports organizations, the acceptance of people with disability in society and sporting clubs, probably also education of kids towards people with disability, and also like in rehab centers, in, you know, supporting people with disabilities to get the opportunity to play sports. at more places, more locations than maybe are accessible at the moment. You know, all those aspects will work towards probably more athletes. So it's not just one, not just one issue that if we solve that, then everything is solved. I think it's a more complicated field.
During those dominant years of your career, what was your profile like at home? How much attention did you get? Did you feel like that extraordinary streak got the attention it deserved? What was the spotlight like on you?
I think I got a really good amount of attention. So I could see that in sponsorships that I got. I could see that the media attention that I got. The streak helped for sure. I think the fact that wheelchair tennis was integrated into Grand Slams at the time that I was playing, and also the comments that, for example, Roger Federer, Nadal, Djokovic said about me, that helped the awareness in the Netherlands for sure. So I, as a person, I have nothing to complain if it comes to the attention and the awareness that I got. I think if I look at the Netherlands now, there's not enough attention, not enough spotlight for the next generation Paralympic athletes. So if you ask somebody in the Netherlands, just a random somebody on the street, name a Paralympic athlete, they can still say my name, but they have a hard time saying other names, or Dieter de Groot, or we are behind now. There's not a new set of athletes that have the same profile as I had, and that's a pity.
Mm. I'm definitely going to need to work on my pronunciation of Dieter de Groot.
Yes.
I've definitely been saying that wrong for a long time. A lot of that coverage that you'd have received and still received, I'm sure after what you went through last year, that there was a lot of this again, would have featured the word inspirational. I don't know what that word is in Dutch, whether there is a direct translation.
Yeah, inspiratie. Yes.
Oh, okay. that I can understand. There's a lot of debate around that word in parasport. Some people really object to it. Where do you stand on that word?
I'm not against it. Definitely not, because I see the combination of the story behind the athlete and the performance. So I'm not against it, and I don't. I sometimes use it myself, but I do see that we need to make the switch towards looking at performances and seeing the sporting part, the athlete part, more than the story behind the athlete. So yeah, I see it as a combination. I mean, the story that I have, I can't delete it. It's part of me. It's part of who I am, and part of the athlete I became and the person I am today. So I can't delete it. And I do realize that for some people, this is inspirational. This could be helpful in their lives. This could be, yeah, something that they can hold on to. But if I would be an athlete at this moment, and I had that as well, being an athlete at that time, you also want to talk about your performance. You also want to talk about your matches. You also want to be asked by journalists for your performance, and not only how great it is that you are playing tennis, or how great it is that you can get in and out of your car yourself. Those questions. So, yeah, I think we need to switch. This is the time that we need to switch to more towards the sporting performance.
Did you ever find it tiresome or tiring to have to represent something more than yourself? I spoke to Billie Jean King last week about, you know, she was never just representing Billie Jean King. She was always representing women, all women.
Yeah.
Were you ever sort of burdened, or did you ever feel burdened by that?
Yeah, during my career, I sometimes did feel that way. And then the second after that, I thought that it's just part of it. And as an athlete, you are a role model. And then so it comes with being more than just that athlete, or being more than just your own person. So it's that package that you just have to deal with. As I look at my life now, I sometimes feel that people expect me to only be an added value within the Paralympic world, while I see myself more in, you know, the sporting world as a whole, as in general, and not only have that stamp of disability sports, Paralympic sports, Paralympic athlete. I can do more, I can be more, I am more than just that. So it's not a burden, but to break out of that is sometimes difficult to take that step.
Would you like to, integration is a word that's come up a lot. Would you like to see more integration at the tournaments of tennis and wheelchair tennis and coverage
sure.
as well?
Yeah, for sure. Of course, there is a difference between able-bodied tennis and wheelchair tennis, and maybe the amount of minutes on television or the amount of live television, there has to be a difference, maybe. But for sure in coverage, for sure in just match planning on courts, and this also is for other sports than just tennis, but I really see the added value if you combine those two worlds. They can strengthen each other. They can be so much added value for spectators, for the aspect of integration in society. They can be so, it could be so helpful.
Mm. How do we achieve that though? Because everybody I know that has been exposed to wheelchair tennis, they come away from it saying, my goodness, that was brilliant to watch.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it might be years before they are exposed to it again. How do we achieve it?
Yeah, I think media is key to that. They can make it happen. It's about the willingness. It's about funding as well, probably, because money is an issue if it comes to that. But the tournaments are already combined during Grand Slams. ABN AMRO tournament in Rotterdam is a combined tournament. So the opportunities are there. Players are there, matches are there. It's then just the planning and the getting space on television or online or that we need to work on. So I guess, yeah, media is a big part of that.
Do you have particular fears or worries about the effect of this pandemic on wheelchair tennis and disability sport, because the pandemic does seem to be exacerbating existing inequalities? Do you fear that wheelchair tennis might take a bigger hit than other areas of the sport?
No, I don't think so. Maybe there was a little bit of a hiccup during the US Open last year, while there was just I think miscommunication to the athletes, and a misunderstanding that they would cancel the wheelchair tennis, but then have the US Open for the able-bodied players. And maybe because of that hiccup, or maybe because of that situation, there is no tournament that will say we're not going to have wheelchair tennis. So in my opinion, it's not harmed by any effect at this moment, but not more than the able-bodied tennis world. So I don't see any big issues or problems coming up. No.
That's good to hear. I was reading that you've designed your own wheelchair. Is that right?
Yeah. In the last, let's say 3 years of my career, I worked on this wheelchair, which I thought this could help me with a lot of just a couple of percentages to play better. And I also had needed some, well, challenge like building your own wheelchair to keep the motivation, to get myself motivated to take those extra steps in the last phase of my career. And so, yes, I built my own chair, which I thought could help me perform better. Yeah.
And is that a chair that was it just sort of one prototype for you, or is it a chair that's now being used by?
Well, this specifically was made for me, but the reason behind why we built this chair, or how we built this chair, is copied by many other players now, and they see the effect that it has on, you know, hitting harder, making a more precise serve. So yeah, thank goodness this is copied, but nobody could have ever played in the exact same chair as I did, because I just have a different disability and a different body and different game style. So a one-on-one copy would never have worked.
Just on the chair, one of the aspects of wheelchair tennis that, or disability sport in general, that's rarely talked about it is the pure practicalities of the travel, it being such an international touring sport, but having, you're not only taking your luggage and kit and rackets and everything with you, but you've also got to transport the chair around the world. I mean,
yeah, and that is one of the most valuable things for a wheelchair tennis player. Yeah, so it's also a risky thing to do, because whenever it's broke or, you know, something's missing, it's not that you just buy another pair of shoes. It's your chair. So it's a thing. It's a hassle to do that every single tournament.
Does it go? I'm getting really into the nitty gritty now. Does it go in the hold of the hold luggage?
Yeah.
So that must be kind of anxiety inducing.
Yeah. Every single time. And whenever you get out of the plane, then fingers crossed to see if it made it to the same destination, and if it makes it to the same destination, to see if it's all complete and not broken. Yeah.
Goodness me. So are there any horror stories of sort of waiting at the baggage carousel?
Many. Yeah. So, and then, yeah, you have to imagine that you, for a Paralympic Games or for a Grand Slam or a big tournament, and then you don't have your chair, and those chairs are expensive, and it's not for everybody to have a spare chair in their backyard. So it's the only thing you have, and if it then just arrived at the other end of the world, or parts are missing, or your whole chair is broken in two, there's some stress moments for sure.
Gosh. Yeah, wow. Your I was looking at your Twitter bio. It ends with the words "full of ambition." What are your remaining ambitions?
Well, we're talking about the integration. I mean, that's part of me that just never wants to stop. So I see integration in more sports, but also in sport federations and in sports organizations. So I do that with my work with my foundation at local clubs. I do that with the ABN AMRO tournament. I do that with my chef de mission role for Tokyo. So I see that as something that in the society that we live in, where I think integration, diversity, inclusion is a hot topic. I see that as opportunities in the next couple of years. So I will probably stick to that and believe in that and spread my belief wherever and to whoever wants to hear it, and see how far we can go, because I believe in fair chances. I believe in fair opportunities for all people. With sports, which I think is a great example on how we can do it, and sports is something that almost all people love, I think we can tell this story, and we can share this story with beautiful examples of athletes.
And if your ambitions are fulfilled, what would you like tennis and wheelchair tennis to look like in 10 years, say?
Wheelchair tennis would be integrated at more tournaments. So not only Grand Slams, but also ATP and WTA tournaments. That the worlds of those athletes come together more often, help each other more often, and that the profile of Paralympic athletes is more than it is now. And what is more? But more known, more appreciated, more respected maybe than it is at the moment. I think that would be a good thing to start with.
Well, it's a fantastic thing to be working towards. And I hope by on the podcast giving a bit of attention to wheelchair tennis, which, as I say, we probably should do more. So this is the starting point. So
absolutely.
Thank you so much for being a part of it.
Thank you so much.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow, Catherine. That was really something. And I mean, I've wanted to hear from her for a long time. And it's lovely that we could have a proper amount of time for you to speak to her in that way. And she was everything I hoped she would be and more. And I just found it so interesting. What stood out for you coming off the phone from her? What stood out for you?
Well, you heard it at the very end there, integration. That striving for integration, and we had a reminder there from Matt before the interview that, you know, wheelchair singles wasn't even played at Wimbledon until 2016. This is really, really recent history we're talking about, that they've even had sort of a halfway decent platform on which to play their sport. But it's a bit like doubles, really. I don't know anybody that hasn't watched an elite level wheelchair tennis match and come away and gone, "Bloomin' heck, that was good." For me, it's yet another argument for best of five week one, best of three week two, because I'm sure scheduling would be a reason at the moment given against greater integration. The high value of centre court and show court scheduling in the latter stages of slams, Yeah, the more I think about our case for that, the more I am just increasingly convinced by it. I mean, we're obviously right.
Well, let's get Esther on the case as well.
Cue Twitter pylon. But yeah, this is doubles and wheelchair tennis, just another reason for it, as far as I'm concerned. So I'd be very much up for that. And as I said, I'm just so fascinated by the psychology of that winning streak and how she said she never felt invincible at any stage during it. I mean, I guess that's what enabled her to continue it for so long. The fact that she wasn't ever complacent, but my mind boggles about it.
My favourite line, I think, is the one where she was match point down in 2008 and she just thought, oh, this is different, sort of felt. You know, what do I do now?
Yes, I love how she can point to a specific match in which she was match point down. Out of the many hundreds that she plays, there was one that really stands out.
Brilliant. Well, what about you, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, the psychology of that winning streak as well for me. I think I was expecting her to talk about it as this really great thing. You know, how great it is to be invincible, to be at the absolute top of your sport. But there were lots of things she spoke about there that obviously it was great to be winning, but there were some tough elements to it that I hadn't really considered. And I think the main one was this idea of athletes are always talking about wanting to improve, wanting to be better. And if you're on a winning streak of over 400 matches, where is there for you to go? I kind of feel like I now see it from that perspective. And I imagine you do start obsessing over your faults in the pursuit of perfection and excellence. And that must be tiring. And this worry that it's going to end. And at the same time, what she said about almost in a way it becoming more of an obsession for journalists than it was for her. Yes, she was interested in it, but I think there was perhaps a lesson for us there. I've certainly done this. I've been guilty of this with the Grand Slam race in the men's game, of constantly looking at the next thing, the next achievement, rather than actually focusing on what they've achieved just now in this moment. I think we can often measure athletes by what they are accumulating rather than actually why what they're doing in the moment. And I feel like Vergeer really felt that.
And tennis is particularly bad for that because there's always the next thing. And the next thing is invariably really close around the corner because of the calendar. Even at the end of the year, you've got a week in the Maldives, if you're lucky, and then you're in the off-season focusing for the next season. Where's the reflection? Makes me think, Simona Halep talked about that, didn't she? I remember when she came into Wimbledon after winning the French and she was just like, yeah, my head's not really in this. I'd really rather be just hugging my French Open trophy.
Yes, and I mean, ultimately, that's how these all-time greats are able to keep doing what they're doing, is because they're not like us. They're not like she. I mean, Esther very politely basically said, if I was like you lot, I wouldn't have done any of it. Right? Because that's how the mentality of a champion works.
There's me desperately trying to relate to it all. And she's like, yeah, stop that. You can't.
You're not going to do it.
Okay. And
I think that's one of the things that Nadal always slightly ticks us off for, isn't it? That you know, you only achieve this if you focus on the next match and don't say, oh, he'll eat him for breakfast, no problem, you know, because Nadal's not, he can't afford to feel like that, because that's when eventually the focus will go and the upset will come. Well, I loved listening to that, Catherine. Thanks for doing it. And, you know, we mean what we say. We want to do other similar types of shows and to get to know other people on the tennis circuit, wheelchair players, doubles players, different characters, so many stories out there to be told, and we want to tell them here on the podcast.
Maybe a Yahanga Khan special. I've done the research.
I bet he was a good tennis player as well.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, we will be back again on Monday with another edition of the Tennis Podcast, in which we'll be looking back on the week that has just gone that is going on as we speak in Charleston, and there are tournaments on clay as well. At the moment, we've just been watching Dan Evans fight it out with Lorenzo Musetti and having three match points. That was hilarious. And Musetti eventually won. So lots and lots to talk about when we get together on Monday. Our mascot for the week is Clancy. If you haven't been monitoring Instagram, do go and have a look, because the Clancy's owner has posted a video of Clancy chasing the tennis ball around, which is absolutely epic. Even I was totally won over by that one. Catherine's mascot for the year, in fact, is who, Catherine?
Is Zeus.
Zeus, of course it
and
is.
And all our chips are on Petra Kvitova, which is... Yeah. Well, it can be a great place to be, but it can also be a very precarious place to be.
Right. OK, well, Rogue, you and I have gone big on Casper Ruud. Matt and Scouser Mousel have gone for who?
Genuinely forgotten who I predicted this week. Got it. Lorenzo Sonego, hoping he will repeat that week where he was the best player in the world. Right, remember that week?
Yeah, not really.
When he beat checked-out Djokovic.
Oh, right, I see. Yes. Billie Jean King is sponsoring Billie Jean the dog, who doesn't get a prediction and who is just asleep at the moment.
She's asleep, yeah.
Yeah, oh, good.
She needs a haircut urgently.
Right.
Which is all of us right now, isn't it?
Yeah, sure is. Our executive producer is Chris Albert Lee.
She's woken up at the mention of her name.
Oh, well, what do you know? Have we got any shout-outs, Matt?
We do for
excellent.
Paul Spence.
All right, Paul. Thanks very
much.
Hello,
Paul.
There's a golfer named Jamie Spence, I remember. I wonder if they're related at all. Masters Week, Paul.
There's a few golfers called Paul as well.
There are, yeah. Carry on, Matt.
Andy Mallon.
Andy.
Oh, we know Andy, don't we?
Lovely.
We
know Andy. Andy's always dropping us a note and saying nice things. Thanks a lot, Andy.
Say hello, Andy.
And someone else we know is Rose Mercier, owner of Oats.
Hey.
Oh,
thanks, Rose.
Hello, Rose. Oh. Thank you for bringing Oats into our lives. Still waiting for confirmation on whether there was ever a haul or whether there will ever be a haul.
Catherine's investigations will continue, and we will be back with another tennis podcast on Monday. Do leave us an iTunes review if you get a chance, and tell your friends about us. We'll see you on Monday.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.